Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and we are continuing with the very epic interview that I did with Brendan Campisi of the Alberta Advantage podcast recently about the history of the Palestinian working class. We are now on the third and final installment of that interview, and in this installment we're going to continue. We're going to talk about the period from the First Intifada in 1987 to the present day, to the present conflict, talking about the period of time from when basically the Palestinians went from being an exploited workforce, you know, exploited by Israeli business, by Israeli capitalism, to basically just being strictly the targets of genocide. You know, the Israeli capitalists do not want them, and now of course they have to fight for survival, and that's where they're at right now, against an overtly genocidal regime. And we're going to talk about how that happened, you know, how, you know, we went from the Palestinian resistance in 1987, you know, and how that is carried forward, you know, through the Oslo, basically the sham Oslo process in the 90s, and through the Second Intifada all the way to the present conflict right now, following October 7th. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. This is the final installment of my interview with Brandon Campisi on the history of the Palestinian working class.
Yeah, because it's understandable people have a hard time wrapping their heads around that, because today obviously it's completely different. Now it's like full on genocidal, and honestly, even before you got to say this stage with post October 7 kind of stage, you already had Palestinians basically increasingly being shut out and replaced by migrant labor from Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And in places like that, they're already trying to find new sources of labor. In fact, one of the problems the Israeli economy has now is even those people are not coming. Obviously, yeah, you have this complete shift since 1987.
Yeah.
So it's basically how did that change, right? Instead of the soft touch, now they're basically just going, they throw that out the window, and now it's just, now it's violence, terror, repression.
Yeah. So that has to do with the, the development of the nationalist movement in the territories. So I said we were sort of going to bracket, things that happen outside of historic Palestine. But, just to summarize, of course, after, it takes a while for Palestinian politics, in the exile, to develop. But from the, from the late 1960s, you have the development of, from the late 1950s, you have the development of the Palestinian nationalist movement. And from, from 1967, you have the development of the full-on sort of resistance movement, that's based in the camps, the refugee camps in Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. And when the occupation starts, initially, of course, the nationalist groups, their first idea is, now we can fight a guerrilla war against Israel in the occupied territories, right? This does not last very long. Basically, especially in the West Bank, Palestine does not have huge mountains and it doesn't have the jungle. And because of the way that the Jordanians had governed the West Bank, through the traditional Palestinian elite, right? Again, they were throwing a lot of communists in prison, and also Ba'athists and other nationalists and so on. But they had a strata of people, landowners and clerics and mayors, who they were able to run the West Bank through. And a lot of people, ordinary people in West Bank society, were able to depend on that traditional elite and were, more or less, satisfied under Jordanian control, right? The West Bank is, compared to Gaza, we'll get to Gaza in a second. The West Bank is, it has cities, it has a history of trade. There's a higher level of development, a higher standard of living. And so people in the West Bank don't necessarily sort of feel the pinch, of Jordanian rule in the way that, nationalists would have wanted them to. And it means that, there is less willingness immediately in the West Bank for people to dive into an armed struggle against the Israeli state that is so powerful, that has just, defeated the Arab armies like a knife cutting through butter, right? This is the perception. And to a large extent, it's the reality, right? Of course, the defeat of the Arab armies by Israel in 1967 is extraordinary on a military level. And it's intimidating to people, right? And it's very difficult. This is something, again, I think an important insight from this history is that, it's important not to, obviously, we respect, the resilience and the strength of the Palestinian people enormously, but it's important not to turn them into, sort of cardboard figures, right? Palestinians, over the course of their history, face the same set of choices in terms of what am I going to risk, for the national cause as any other, right? They're not superhuman, right? And so there are long periods when the number of Palestinians who are willing to risk their freedom and their lives, to fight their various, national, adversaries is not large, right? And in the West Bank in 1967, 1968, most people were not ready to dive into an armed struggle against Israel. In fact, many people were willing to sort of wait and see what life would be like under the occupation. So, you know, again, there's no mountains, there's no jungle. And then in the social sense, you know, the guerrillas are not able to swim among fish, you know, among the people like fish and water. And so the attempt to start guerrilla war in the West Bank does not last very long at all. Gaza is very different, right? As I mentioned earlier, right? The crucial thing about Gaza is that it is created anew in 1948, or between 1948 and 1950, right? Gaza in 1947 is a small trading town on the Mediterranean, and it has a hinterland, you know, sort of the agricultural produce of southern Palestine flows into it, and then basically to Jaffa from there. But then 200,000 people are forced out of their homes at gunpoint in southern Palestine. And in fact, in the south, some of them are forced out of their homes at gunpoint long after the war is over. That's still going on in the year 1950. And they are dumped into Gaza, and they set up these camps that, you know, remain to this day, or sort of remain to this day. And there is no economy, right? People are incredibly poor, and they're deeply resentful of their dispossession. And that's why Gaza is the hub of resistance, right? It is because the people of Gaza from 1948 to today have never had anything to lose, right? The Egyptians, you know, in fact, the nationalism and the resistance spirit in Gaza under the Egyptians was so strong, the Egyptians didn't always know what to do with it, right? At certain points, they allowed people to carry out, you know, guerrilla attacks on the Israeli settlements just outside. And then at certain points, the Egyptians cracked down on that because it became politically inconvenient to them. And it meant that in Gaza, as soon as the Israelis come in, there is the basis for an insurgency. And basically, between 1968 and 1972, Gaza is the site of a guerrilla war, mainly led by the PFLP, in which, you know, at its height, people on both sides said things like, you know, the Israelis control Gaza during the day, and the, you know, the Palestinian guerrillas control it at night. You know, the sort of the landscape of the camps becomes the equivalent of the jungle to the extent that the Israelis actually destroy areas of certain camps and clear them out. And they try to rebuild things in ways that are less dense, so it's easier for them to move around in. They deport. That's the softest thing they do. They deport thousands of people into the Sinai because their relatives are involved in the resistance, right? Again, don't want to understate the level of brutality that exists in this period when and where people were fighting. So Gaza is a tougher nut to crack, right? Of course, people in Gaza, you know, today are very proud of this, understandably. So it takes until about 1972 for the Israelis to be in control of Gaza. But at that point, the Israelis could say that they had more or less successfully contained the resistance in the territories that they'd taken over in 1967. There did not seem to be any immediate material threat to their, you know, to their control there. And this only changes because of sort of external political reasons. So in October 1973, of course, Egypt and Syria, you know, go to war with Israel. They go to war in order to improve their bargaining position to get their territories back. You know, Golan and Sinai. And they have some success in that endeavor, of course. We know eventually Egypt gets the Sinai back. But the important thing is, immediately after the October 1973 war, everybody in the Middle East knows the balance of forces has changed. Israel does not have the same sort of overwhelming power that it did in 1967. And there's a sense that there would be some sort of negotiating process that might get the Arab states their land back. And there's a sense that maybe the Israelis might even withdraw from the West Bank and Gaza as part of this process. This is where the idea of a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, which the resistance movement had rejected up to that point, enters into the discussion of the resistance movement. And so at that time, the Palestinian resistance groups that have developed, you know, in the diaspora, Fatah, Popular Front, Democratic Front, and so on, they decide that they need to start doing a lot more organizing on the inside in the occupied territories. And they start sending cadre into the West Bank and Gaza to build up organizations. And they connect with, you know, a younger cohort of people who are responding to the conditions of the occupation, who've started, you know, forming organizations of various kinds, student groups, union groups, women's groups, in order to respond to that. And so the national movement develops in the territories in the mid-70s in a new form. There is, of course, armed action. There's always armed action on a small scale. But basically, the groups have decided that they're going to be building up unions and student organizations and women's organizations, and they're going to be leading demonstrations in the streets, right? That that's going to be the form of struggle against the occupation. The goal is to make sure that everybody in the world knows, the goal of the movement as a whole is to make sure that everybody in the world knows that the people in the territories are behind the PLO, just like the people in the refugee camps are behind the PLO. And of course, the goal of each individual organization is to gain as much, you know, as much of a mass base as they possibly can. And so they start, you know, organizing these different sectors of society in the territories. And one negative feature of this is that every group sets up its own union federation, right? So there are the existing unions that are basically led by the Jordanian Communist Party, which continues to operate in the West Bank during this period. It becomes the Palestinian Communist Party in 1982. But up to that point, it's the Palestinian section of a Jordanian Communist Party, basically. There's the unions that those people have been leading for decades. And then the Popular Front started organizing unions of their own, and the Democratic Front started organizing unions of their own. Eventually, Fatah organizes unions of its own, and the very small Palestinian Baathists organize unions of their own. So from a purely trade union perspective of trying to build up the strongest force for organized labor, this is obviously not a great situation. But it's, you know, it's a necessary or inevitable consequence of the way the Palestinian national movement is divided in this period. Initially, people aren't really sure what to do with these workers going into Israel. The Popular Front actually treats them at the very beginning as traitors, which, you know, I think it speaks to the Popular Front, you know, was a newly formed organization at that time, and they hadn't really absorbed, you know, Marxism in a really deep way. So there wasn't any sympathy for, you know, the need for the proletarian to put, you know, to put bread on their table. And so the workers going into Israel in 1968 were seen as traitors to the cause. Eventually, they come around on this. In the 1970s, in the mid-1970s, the Democratic Front starts basically engaging in trade union activity among these Palestinian migrant workers who go into Israel every day. And again, like the very early organization of Palestinian workers in the 1920s, it takes particularly low-key forms because of the situation. I should say, to explain the situation of these workers in trade union terms, they are not members of the Israeli unions. Basically, they have to pay dues to the Israeli union organization, the Histadrut, which is, at this time, still one of the central organizations of Israeli society. It's part of the state. It's the healthcare system. It's part of the education system. You know, it's very closely tied to the ruling labor party, but it also does trade union functions for Jewish workers. The Palestinian citizens of Israel could not be members of the Histadrut until 1959, and they could not vote in its elections until 1966. But the non-citizen Palestinian workers in the territory or coming from the territories are not members of the Histadrut at all, although they basically have to pay a tax that amounts to paying dues for it. And then also within the Israeli labor movement, besides sort of the specific trade union branches, there are these sort of workplace committees that represent everybody in a workplace, sort of regardless of trade union membership. Structures like this exist in many countries, especially where the union movement is divided. And Palestinian, non-citizen Palestinian workers are technically supposed to be represented by these committees. Again, simply by virtue of being in a given workplace. But predictably, the, you know, Israeli Jewish workers who run these committees are not especially concerned with their problems, to put it no more strongly than that. You sort of have a shift in the occupational hierarchy during this time, where sort of the Palestinian non-citizens are at the lowest level, and then you have the Palestinian citizens, and then you have Middle Eastern Jews, and then you have Jews of European descent. That's sort of incidental. But in any case, because these workers don't have effective trade union representation at all, most of what the early union activity among this workforce looks like is sort of legal assistance, right? Where basically you have activists trying to make sure that Palestinian workers who are going into Israel know what Israeli labor law says about their rights so that they are able to engage in sort of the most basic activity, you know, in terms of advocating for their rights, you know, in the workplace. They're not in a position to be able to strike. Even in the territories, there are very few strikes. I'll get into that in a moment. Almost no Palestinian worker in this period has the necessary leverage to actually engage in a work stoppage. They're simply too vulnerable for that. So it takes other forms. And while it's pioneered by the Democratic Front, over time, the other sections of the Palestinian national movement and their affiliated labor groups start to organize these workers. In the Palestinian economy, strictly speaking, basically in any situation where you have a Palestinian employer and Palestinian workers, at the beginning of the occupation, the existing forces in the labor movement led by the communists say, we are going to freeze the class struggle in the Palestinian economy, right? They have, you know, an analysis of the national question that comes from Marxism-Leninism. They say, you know, we are at the national democratic stage, you know, the national liberation stage. You know, the Palestinian employers, such as they are, and of course they are, in fact, very weak. You know, the Palestinian employers are not an enemy at this stage at all, basically. And so we are not going to, you know, we're not going to pursue struggle against Palestinian employers by Palestinian workers. We're not going to have strikes, you know, within the economy, you know, within the sort of minimal Palestinian economy that exists. And this basically holds until the Intifada. The Intifada complicates it. It doesn't end it. The Intifada changes the way that works. And it's interesting because on the one hand, of course, there is still class struggle in Palestinian society at the level of the workplace, right? It's impossible to avoid the fact that in a workplace, the worker and the employer have conflicting interests, right? They will inevitably have conflicting interests around wages and hours and so on. And so there are very occasionally strikes, and then more frequently, there are other forms of struggle that go on between Palestinian workers and employers in the territories. But basically, the national movement provides a framework in which the different classes of Palestinian society are basically compelled to mediate their disputes, right? The national movement sort of insists on workers and employers coming to agreement, you know, pretty quickly, pretty simply, whenever, you know, whenever these struggles do develop. The source that I'm getting all of this from is this fantastic book called Behind the Intifada, which is about workers organizing and women's organizing in the occupied territories up to, you know, up to the first Intifada. And he goes into all the details about the different sort of factional conflicts between the various, you know, Palestinian labor federations and how they were affected by different, you know, political conflicts between different groups. And I'm not going to go into any of that. But that is sort of the general pattern that that these things take, you know, during the first two decades of the occupation.
Yeah, because that brings us up to the Intifada, which of course, you know, the first Intifada and the second Intifada, which ultimately, of course, lead us up to where we are today. And I guess that's probably where we should end on, is this this kind of last period, if you will. But of course, you know, you have this just the increased, you have increased accelerated settler colonialism, you know, you have increased militarization, and you increasingly have the Palestinians themselves being forced out of the labor market, shall we say, which of course, I mean, you know, this is yet another wave of dislocation.
Yeah, so how this change starts, I think it's very, very important to recognize that before Israel begins to expel the Palestinians from its economy, you have a, you know, basically the slaves revolt first, right? You have a period of extraordinary, another one of these periods, again, you know, I think the Palestinian revolt in the 30s is an extraordinary event in the annals of anti-colonial struggle around the globe. And I think the first Intifada is similar. So what this book before the Intifada, you know, sort of argues is that, you know, even though there are all these complications, all these, you know, internal struggles, even though, you know, trade union activity didn't really look like trade union activity in other parts of the world, the period of organizing, you know, especially from the mid-1970s to the outbreak of the Intifada, created the organizational basis for what happens, right, when the uprising actually does break out. It trains activists, it creates sort of these reflexes of mobilization. This is basically, maybe some listeners will be familiar with this, there's an extraordinary novel that was just translated into English called The Trinity of Fundamentals, and it describes the experiences of a PFLP activist in the West Bank in the 1980s and then during the Intifada. And when the Intifada breaks out, it's just the most beautiful, you know, vindication for this young activist. He joined the movement, you know, as a teenager in the 1970s, you know, and he's been struggling all these years. And he was always frustrated with how people just sort of made ordinary lives for themselves under the occupation. They, you know, they got along, and you know, he really emphasizes, you know, when the uprising broke out, you know, it's this extraordinary vindication. It shows that you have to just keep working. You have to plant the seed because one day it will happen. And that basically is what happens, you know, on a large scale for this whole cohort of Palestinian militants. So, you know, the first Intifada breaks out, really it could have broken out over anything, right? There's a rising tide of mass popular struggle in the territories through the 1980s. You have confrontations in the streets, you have demonstrations, the campuses are alive with political struggle, especially. And then at the end of 1987, a full-scale uprising breaks out, first, again, in Gaza, in the Jabalia refugee camp, and then it spreads to all the other camps, and then it spreads to virtually the entirety of the Palestinian population. And initially, you have an attempt to have a total general strike by the Palestinian workers in Israel, right? There's this idea, you know, as the uprising sort of blossoms and you have this extraordinary sort of organizational structure that's created, the unified national leadership of the uprising, which consists of sort of committees of local activists everywhere. And then it's tied to, you know, the PLO leadership outside. To emphasize, actually, since we're talking about the workers' movement, the left is absolutely key to the leadership of the Intifada, especially in the West Bank. The four main components of these committees of the unified national leadership of the uprising, you know, you have Fatah, of course, which is by far the most popular Palestinian party at this time. It is the default Palestinian nationalist party. But then the three other main forces in these committees are the Palestinian Communist Party, which again was formed in 1982 from the Jordanian Communist Party, the Democratic Front, and the Popular Front. So you have three Marxist-Leninist organizations that are playing an absolutely key role in the national leadership. In Gaza, Islamic Jihad actually works with the newly formed Hamas. But the Islamists don't have any influence in the West Bank at this stage, basically. And in some local areas, you actually have the Communists or the Popular Front or the Democratic Front exercising overall leadership of the uprising at the level of a village, a camp, you know, a neighborhood. So the left is actually is quite strong in this, you know, in this phase of the struggle. And there's this idea that they can use the leverage the Palestinian workers and they have in the Israeli economy to sort of escalate, you know, the Intifada. And the Intifada consists of all forms of activity you can imagine. It is an extraordinary, anyway, I keep saying this, but just to explain what I really mean is, what's extraordinary about the Intifada is that such a broad spectrum of people are taking part in some kind of action. The famous image of the Intifada is young men in the streets and teenage boys in the streets throwing rocks and Molotovs at the IDF. That's very important. But you have people, you know, you have, you know, women making the Molotov cocktails and bagging up stones and giving them to the young men. You have people building barricades. You have, we'll get into it, you have workers going on strike. You have people organizing education when the Israelis shut down the school system. You have people boycotting Israeli goods, right? The first people to boycott Israeli goods were the Palestinians during the Intifada. You have people cultivating the land so that they can feed the population without buying Israeli goods or without doing wage labor in Israel. You have school strikes, and then sometimes you have efforts to keep the schools open when it's the Israelis who are shutting them down. And there are all these different ways to participate, right? It's not, of course, it's uneven, but there is participation across age differences, across gender differences. You know, the different factions are broadly all working together, you know, especially at the height of the Intifada. And this is all in its first year. Later on, it takes other forms and there's more armed action. But in the first year, it is this broad, multifaceted, popular campaign of defiance, right? This campaign of showing that they do not accept the occupation, that the occupation is not legitimate, right? Because the Israelis had defeated the PLO in Lebanon in 1982, and the Palestinian National Movement spends the rest of the 1980s wandering in the wilderness, right? They were very weak. They were subject to the machinations of the Arab states. You know, the leadership of the PLO is you know, they're knocking at the Americans' door. They're shacking up with the Jordanians. They're desperate, right? And then the population in the territories basically saves them. The population in the territories rises up and says, you know, whatever, you know, it may have looked like for 20 years, we are Palestinians. We want freedom. We want a state. We want independence. We want the end of the occupation. And workers play a really, really important role in that. And while it becomes clear that they can't ask all the Palestinians who work in Israel to stop working in Israel, what they do is they develop this pattern of one day. Two things happen. They develop a pattern of one day strikes, right? There's a great book that came out in 1989, put out by American, you know, solidarity activists. And at the end, they have this appendix of all the communiques of the unified national leadership of the uprising. So there would be, you know, a strike, right? There might be a school strike one week and then a strike by workers the next. And then, oh, this is the day when we want, you know, the young people to come out and, throw stones and Molotovs, right? And so on these one-day strikes, Palestinian workers who you know worked in Israel would be encouraged, you know, to the furthest possible extent to stay home that day. And this starts having a huge effect, right? I think it's Hilterman, the author of Behind the Intifada, who cites some documents on this, that, you know, it was impossible to ignore, especially in sectors like construction, right? These days when the Palestinian Arab workers from the territories were not showing up were very, very noticeable. They did encourage Palestinians who worked building the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza to quit, right? That's one of the most perverse elements. And again, you know, people need to eat, you know, the proletarian condition is you need to reproduce your labor power by doing wage labor for somebody. And for some Palestinians in the occupied territories, that has meant building the illegal apartheid settlements on their own land, tragically. But during the Intifada, the nationalist leadership says, okay, at least these people should quit. And many of them do. Many of those people go back to their villages and they start cultivating the land, right? Rather than continue to work in this sort of obviously humiliating and sort of self-betraying, self-defeating manner. And it is only because of this period of, you know, proletarian self-activity in the context of this massive national anti-colonial uprising that the Israelis start changing the management of labor. There's actually... And this will be, again, familiar from the contemporary situation. There's a state component to this, and then there's sort of a popular fascist component to it. And the popular fascist component, I think, is less well known today, but it might help explain something, you know, it might be sort of useful to talk about, which is, you know, I mentioned the slave markets, right, in southern Israel, sort of in, you know, in and around, you know, around Gaza. During the Intifada, Palestinian men who still, you know, went out to the slave markets to get a job for the day start being attacked violently. There are instances where these workers are actually murdered just on the side of the highway by ordinary Israelis or by, you know, by far right activists. And so I think, you know, you can see with things like that, the sort of the seed of the kind of spirit of sort of genocidal revenge, you know, that is so dominant in Israeli society today. They were so, you know, infuriated by the fact that these people would dare to, you know, to rise up, that, you know, they would no longer be treated as, you know, a potentially sort of docile labor force. They were now all enemies. And then the state component of that, of course, is the beginning of this system of permits and checkpoints and closures of specific areas, whether the West Bank or Gaza. You know, you can find accounts describing Gaza as a prison, an open-air prison, as far back as the 1990s. That's not something that starts with the beginning of the blockade in 2007, much less, you know, October of last year. This is actually something that starts during the First Intifada, because again, Gaza is seen as being a particularly difficult place, a particularly resistant place, because it is. And so they want to punish the people of Gaza more harshly. And so the system of permits starts getting created, right? You know, only so many people can come into Israel this day, et cetera. And, or rather, that already existed, but it starts being applied much more restrictively. The numbers start getting lowered. And yeah, by, you know, by the end of the Intifada, 1993, Israeli capital is coming to terms with the fact that, which again, Israeli capital has to respond to the political plans of the state, right? Obviously, the easiest thing, the automatic thing in an ordinary situation of even colonial capitalism would have been for the colonial capitalists to keep exploiting the labor force that they keep under occupation. But for political purposes, it becomes impossible to do that, right? And so the Israeli state tells Israeli capital, no, you can't have these workers anymore, at least not nearly in the same numbers. And, you know, Israeli capital, true to its historical pattern, makes do, right? And they start looking abroad, as you mentioned, right? They start going to Southeast Asia, they start going to other parts of the world to recruit workers to do the same sort of things. When this, again, of course, puts Israel squarely in the company of every other imperialist country, you know, just like, you know, just like Canada. You know, I live in Southwestern Ontario and there's lots of farms here that are dependent on, you know, temporary foreign workers. And sort of, you know, the more Israel sort of shuns Palestinian labor in some ways, the more it resembles other Palestinians, other, you know, imperialist societies. And then on the other hand, you do have this sort of, you know, fascist radicalization. There's, you know, there's a thread here about, you know, what are the impacts of whether people in the two nationalities have day-to-day, whether they have day-to-day contact or not. You know, I think you can speculate on that from a liberal perspective more than from Marxist or anti-colonial one necessarily. But in any case, on the economic level, we know what happens, which is the Intifada is extremely difficult for Palestinian society. The boycott of Israeli goods is very, very difficult to sustain. It's very costly. The strikes are very difficult to sustain. They're extremely costly materially. And from 1988, you know, the decreasing Israeli demand for labor from the territories is, you know, it really, really hits, right? And, you know, Palestinian people accept this as a necessary, you know, sacrifice for the national cause to an extent. And under, you know, the Oslo period is so contradictory, right? Because on the one hand, everything is supposed to be normal, right? And there is investment. And there are affluent Palestinians from other parts of the world who come home, they come to the territories, they set up businesses, you know, trade is opened up, you know, with Jordan and so on. Trade, actually, I didn't get into the international economics of the occupation in the first few decades, but Israel used the West Bank to trade with Jordan before they were legally allowed to trade with Jordan after they made peace with them. But in any case, so, you know, and of course, sort of the social basis for Oslo is that you have bourgeois Palestinian forces, right, who are, you know, the social base of the Palestinian Authority, the social base of the collaborationists, and so on. But that's a really, really small group. And for most people, you know, the Intifada is the end of the relative prosperity that they'd experienced during the first couple decades of the occupation. And it does not get better in the Oslo period, because as we know, you know, during the Oslo period, the Israelis continue to do everything that they were doing to undermine Palestinian society. Settlements expand. Again, a Palestinian farmer who wants to dig a well on his own land still has to ask permission from a military authority that will never give it to him. And this other source of income, wage labor in Israel, is increasingly difficult to come by. And that, you know, this is not a story that has a happy ending, obviously, right? Because that's been the trend ever since, right? During the 2010s, right, which in retrospect are now this sort of very brief period of partial, very unequal, very contested, very tense normalization, there were more Palestinian workers who were allowed back into Israel. This labor migration has never stopped. I think it's important to stress that. It does still happen. Even from Gaza, before October 7th, it was still going on. It's just on a much, much smaller scale, a qualitatively smaller scale than it was, you know, between 1968 and 1988. And in Gaza especially, you know, since the beginning of the siege, you have a really extraordinary situation where basically both capitalists and workers almost disappear, right? You know, as it becomes more and more difficult to import anything, you know, it becomes more, all these, you know, I talked about the Israeli branch plant economy in the territories. That's all gone now. Or it might still exist in the West Bank. I don't know the details there. But in Gaza, where it was quite important, it's gone. And then Sarah Roy talks about how basically between 2006 and 2010, almost every factory in Gaza shut its doors, right? There are still workers in Gaza. You know, there are still people who live by wage labor. There are still, you know, people who own businesses and so on. But in the conditions of the siege, again, not even talking about, you know, the conditions of total displacement and the destruction of every physical infrastructure and everything that's happened in the last nearly year, you know, in the, you know, the conditions of siege and periodic attack between 2007 and 2023, basically most people in Gaza are declassed. By the mid-2010s, most people in Gaza were dependent for their day-to-day subsistence on international food aid. So this is, you know, again, Roy coins de-development in the 1990s. This is sort of the most advanced stage of de-development, right? Where there really is a push to destroy any kind of basic economic infrastructure. And that's the general trend, right? There is, in 2021, during the Unity Intifada, there was actually a, you know, one of these days of mass strike, you know, across the territories involving both labor and, you know, people with small businesses. So there is still, you know, mobilizing capacity and organizing capacity that's there. But again, overall, you know, it has to be recognized that, you know, the general trend of all of this in recent history is, as you said, acceleration of that settler colonial project. An acceleration, I would, you know, add of that project specifically of, you know, of de-development, in the sense of sort of the destruction of any kind of economic fabric on which Palestinian society could exist.
Acceleration of, genocide. Like that's basically what's going on, right? And I'm assuming like you would certainly see the parallels between, say, that and some of the maybe less intense, but I mean, still, you know, the efforts that were made against Indigenous people in say Canada, which I mean you're very well acquainted with, to kind of keep them down, to ultimately destroy their economic floor, their economic base. Yeah. Any sort of independence that they had, any sort of, independent living existence that they had. And basically we're seeing that in Palestine right now. You know, is there any wonder why there's that solidarity? I mean, I've seen pictures of the Haudenosaunee flag, the Mohawk flag, you know, appearing in various parts of occupied Palestine.
Yeah.
As like an expression of solidarity.
Incredibly moving.
Yeah. But it's like, is it any wonder, you know, that connection is being made?
Yeah.
right, between those peoples. And but yeah, this is basically where we're at right now. And we see like how genocide basically, it is one of those things that actually can basically declass you. Like one of the few things that actually might have the power to actually do that. In the arsenal that, say, oppressing forces have. And this is why we stand in solidarity with the resistance as well, right? This is why that's so critical right now. Because this really is a battle for survival at this point.
Yeah, like, it is
full on, right?
Most literal way, life and death.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's where we're gonna end it today. That was just epic. We went for over 2 hours there. So thank you so much, Brendan, for joining me, for being on the show again. I know it's been quite a long time. So I'm really glad that we did this, and thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, no problem at all.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me, the Bill of Rights froze me, in jails they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and leap on me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body, their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me, materialists test me, pollution that chokes me, movies that joke me, politicians exploit me, city life that jades me, Hudson Bay fleets me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
This is for Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine. While we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools, Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse of the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume, and it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew, they're just people
people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war that is murdering more rapidly, and we are automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family. Palestine remains in my heart forever. We stand for peace, times of war, we shan't surrender. Remember, it didn't start in this dark December. Every coin is a bullet if you're Marks and Spencer. And when you're sipping Coca-Cola, that's another pistol in the holster of them soulless soldiers. You say you know about the Zionist lobby, but you put money in their pocket when you're buying their coffee. Talking about revolution sitting in Starbucks. The fact is, that's the type of thinking I can't trust, let alone even start to respect. Before you talk, learn the meaning of that scarf on your neck. Forget Nestle, Obama promised Israel 30 billion over the next decade. They're trigger happy and they're crazy. Think about that when you're putting Huggies nappies on your baby. Just a war over stolen land. Why do you think little boys are throwing stones at tanks? And we'll never really know how many people are dead. They drop bombs on innocent girls while they sleep in their bed. Don't get offended by facts, just try and listen. Nothing is more anti-Semitic than Zionism. So please don't bring bad vibes when you speak to me. There's plenty of rabbis that agree with me. It's your choice what you do with this message. Don't get it confused, I view this from a human perspective. How many more resolutions have to be violated? How many more children have to be annihilated? Israel is a terror state, they're terrorists that terrorize. I testify, my television televised, I'm telling lies. This is not a war, it is systematic genocide. But whatever they try, Palestine will never die. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza. Palestine, Ramallah, West Bank, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for an answer. Wish I could take your tears and replace them with laughter. Long live Palestine, long live Gaza.